our next presentation, Implicit Sequence Specific Motor Learning in Individuals with Chronic Stroke, Spatial and Temporal Accuracy. And our presenters are Tessa, Devin, and Stephanie.
All right, so we're going to get started. Tessa, Devin, and Stephanie. Thank you for still being awake and meeting with us on the third day of these research presentations. So as Elizabeth Bean said, our presentation is Implicit Sequence-Specific Motor Learning in Individuals with Chronic Stroke, and we're going to be looking at specifically the spatial and temporal components. So just a quick overview of what we're going to be covering. We're going to look at the background and purpose, the methods, the results, discussion. We're going to cover little implications with physical therapists, and then our question and answer period. So the purpose of our study was to verify if sequence-specific implicit motor learning occurs in individuals with chronic middle cerebral artery strokes, and we wanted to further investigate the effect of middle cerebral artery stroke on the spatial and temporal components of implicit learning, and this was done using a sequence-specific motor test. So just a bit of background about stroke itself and the burden of it on healthcare. Currently, it is the leading cause of adult disability in North America. It is the third most prevalent cause of death in Canada and the fourth most prevalent cause of death in the United States. It affects over 300,000 Canadians. It has approximately a $43 billion annual price tag in the United States, which is direct and indirect healthcare costs. 67% of stroke survivors are left with permanent disability, while 60% have impaired hand function. And one of the most important things that we found in one of our studies was that quality of life is actually what's reported as decreasing. And this study looked at people from 96 to 2005. And they did self-reported surveys, basically. And they just kind of noticed that what they were reporting was decrease in quality of life, and they also noticed that they had a decrease in cognition and in hand dexterity, and we thought that was pretty amazing. So just a little bit of our rationale for kind of how we tied everything together that we're looking at. One of the reasons we looked at the middle cerebral artery is because it is the most common site for infarct, and with our aging population, we all know that the silver tsunami, we keep hearing about it, it's about to crest. So we're expecting to see a large rise in the incidence of stroke. And for physiotherapists, we need to kind of find an effective rehabilitation technique that focuses on motor function. And this is important as the ability to learn motor skills is essential for rehabilitation. So the next few slides, we're just going to go over some of the definitions that we used for our project. So motor learning, the definition that we use, is a set of processes associated with practice or experience leading to relatively permanent changes in the capability for responding. So the big part here is that to demonstrate learning, it needs to be a permanent change that's demonstrated over time. So when we look at learning, there's two components that we looked at, explicit learning and implicit learning. Explicit learning is the ability to accurately recall information, and you can do this even after just one exposure. This is done consciously, it's accessible via recall memory, and it uses cognitive processes, and it is stored in the medial temporal lobe, so it's actually stored focally. Implicit learning, on the other hand, it's a bit different. It is the ability to acquire complex information, and the key part here is that you can learn this information without knowing A, what you're learning, or that you're learning. And we'll go into a bit of an example in just a second. So implicit learning develops over time with numerous exposures to the information or continuous practice of a skill. And unlike explicit learning that's got that focal location, this is actually distributed throughout various regions of the brain. So some of the areas that it's been shown to, I think they found it, is in the cerebellum, sensory motor cortex, supplemental motor cortex, prefrontal cortex, thalamus, and basal ganglia. And one of the reasons we listed all these is that everything other than the cerebellum is supplied by the middle cerebral artery. So if you kind of go back to the initial talks, is that we're looking at strokes in this area. Furthermore, one of the most important parts about implicit learning is that it is an element for motor learning, and that kind of ties in everything about the rehabilitation that we're looking at. One of the important things as well about implicit learning is we don't know whether it's unilateral in the brain or bilateral. So we're not sure if you just take this out on one side, if it is able to compensate on the other side. So an example of explicit implicit instructions, I know it's kind of the small writing on the figure, so don't worry about it if you can't read it at the back, but if you were trying to teach someone to walk, the explicit way of doing it At toe off, activate your hip flexors to accelerate your limb through the first 20 degrees of hip flexion, and so on and so forth. If you went into a rehab setting and told someone to do that, they'd look at you like you had three heads and be like, are you kidding me? So, and if you think back to when you were a kid, your parents didn't sit there and tell you all that stuff. You just kind of stood up and gave it a go. That's an example of implicit learning. You just tried it and you sorted it out and you don't have to think about it. You're right. Implicit learning can also be broken down into two other components, which we are specifically looking at. So we've got spatial accuracy and temporal accuracy. Spatial accuracy is the ability to locate objects in space, and this involves the motor cortex. Again, I'm not sure if this is solely unilateral or bilateral. Temporal accuracy relates to the timing of movement, and this involves the cerebellum. So a good example of this is trying to hit a tennis ball with a tennis racket or any other sports analogy that you prefer to use. So the spatial component, you need to get the racket into the same physical space as the ball. And the temporal component, you need to swing the racket at the right time to match the ball's speed. Because you can do both, but if they aren't combined, not going to hit it. So the whole key point there is that you need to have a combination. You need to be in the right place at the right time. So if you think about this from a physiotherapy point of view with the study population we're looking at, trying to teach someone who's just suffered a stroke how to get upstairs. They need to have the spatial accuracy to lift their leg high enough to clear the stair, but they also have to have the temporal accuracy to be able to lift it and then alternate legs. And if one of those parts is missing, you're going to find constant tripping and it's going to be a really difficult process. So just a little bit of background about the research that we found on this so far. There's only been a little bit of research done on the effects of specifically the middle cerebral artery stroke, or middle cerebral artery strokes, on temporal and spatial components. And this study specifically looked at the basal ganglia, and we're looking at the whole distribution of the BMCA. And in 2006, Boyd and Winstein did a study on cerebellar infarcts and looked at the temporal and spatial components. And what they found is that temporal accuracy was impaired, which makes sense because we know that the cerebellum plays a role with timing and coordination movements. But with this, with these strokes, the spatial accuracy was able to improve and wasn't all that impaired compared to the temporal. So we figure that more research into the sequence-specific implicit motor learning is warranted to enhance our treatment strategies. From now on, if we say implicit learning, we're actually talking about sequence-specific implicit motor learning. It's just kind of a mouthful and kind of sounds like a German song. So if you hear us say implicit learning and it says sequence-specific motor learning up there, they mean the same. So, implicit learning, so far it's been demonstrated in people with middle cerebral artery strokes, so we know that this population can implicitly learn. Furthermore, they can implicitly learn without explicit instruction. And one study's actually shown that explicit instructions can actually disrupt implicit learning in this population. So before we get into the methods that Stephanie will cover, just kind of wanted to clarify our study aim. We wanted to examine changes in the temporal and spatial accuracy of sequence-specific implicit motor learning in individuals with chronic stroke in the middle cerebral artery distribution. And our hypothesis is that sequence-specific implicit learning will be demonstrated, and we expect to see a bit of a difference in spatial and temporal accuracy, but we're just not sure what to expect. So I'll pass it over to Stephanie.
Thank you, Tessa. Okay, so our present study is part of a larger study that's being conducted through the Brain Behavior Lab. By Boyd and Ng et al. And the larger study is entitled Promotion of Brain Reorganization After Stroke, and it's received ethics approval from the UBC Clinical Ethics Research Board. So just to give you an overview of the study, the participants were recruited from GF Strong, BGH, and Lionsgate Hospitals, as well as a stroke database run by Dr. Janice Ng. Subjects were then screened for the inclusion and exclusion criteria, which I'll go over very shortly. These screening tools included the Fugelmeyer, the French aphasia screen, and the MoCA. And if they received acceptable screening scores, subjects were then walked through informed consent and then randomized into one of three groups based on the consort statement. We used the control group of the larger study as our experimental group, and we'll refer to them as such for the remainder of the presentation. So participants were included if they were older than 18 years old, and if they had the first clinically diagnosed stroke, particularly if it it had to be an ischemic stroke in the middle cerebral artery or a functional equivalent, and it needed to be greater than 6 months since the stroke. They needed to have impaired motor function in their upper extremity, and needed to have passing scores on the screening tests I mentioned earlier. On the Fugelmeyer, they needed greater than 20. On the MoCA, they needed greater than 24. And on the French grade, they needed greater than 13. So as you can see here, we have some MRI images of three of our participants' brains. And the red circle just denotes the lesion that you find in the MRI, or in the MCA distribution. And the MRIs were taken as part of the larger study protocol. And for the purposes of our study, we used these images to basically verify that where the lesion location was for inclusion. Subjects were excluded if they had a major psychiatric diagnosis or a history of substance abuse, if they tested on testing if they demonstrated neglect, or if they had a history of seizures or epilepsy. The next four exclusion criteria, pregnancy, obesity, and metal in the body, and claustrophobia, were particular to the MRI that they required for the larger study. Again, if they had a score less than 13 on the expression and comprehension sections of the French aphasia screening test, they were excluded. As well as if they took drugs that impaired brain plasticity, they had a history of tumor or head trauma, or if their upper extremity impairment was so great that they actually couldn't participate in our motor task, they were excluded from the study. So in this picture here, you can see a sample subject. He's lying supine on a plinth, and he's using his stroke-affected arm to operate a lightweight lever on a frictionless inclined surface. The lever includes a mouse, which is connected to the computer screen, which you can see just behind his head there. And he's able to visualize that screen through a mirror system that's just above his eyes. So on that screen, there'll be a target cursor, which you see is that black circle there, off to the left. And then the participant's cursor, the red dot there, is what he's controlling with the mouse. And so the target cursor will cross the screen. It won't leave a trace, so that the subject's not able to visualize the tracing. And he will track that cursor with his own red dot. Now off to the right on this figure, you'll see the random and repeated and random sequences, the tracings there. That gives you an example of the trajectory that the participant would be tracking. And the participant is unaware that there's a repeated sequence that's been embedded within the tracings that the computer target cursor goes through. So they'll practice both random and repeated segments. At the end of the study, subjects were asked if they were aware that there was a repeated sequence embedded within the practice task, and they reported that they were unaware. So our experimental protocol was 7 days long, and each participant began on day one with consent, screening tests, and baseline testing. Days 2 to 6, they practiced the motor task, and then on day 7, they went through attention testing. And this gives you a bit of a rough outline of how the task was broken down. So on day 1 and 7, there were 4 total blocks that the subjects walked through. Each block consisted of trials, and trials were 18 seconds long. So a trial would basically be the computer cursor crossing the screen, and that would take 18 seconds for that to occur. So if you look at day 1, block 1 and 3, they had 2 trials of rest, followed by 8 trials of repeated sequence, 2 trials of rest, 8 trials of random, and then 2 trials of rest. And so on the retention and baseline testing on days 1 and 7, they walked through blocks 1 and 4, practicing both sequences. And on their practice days 2 to 6, they practiced one block, block 1, of random sequences, and blocks 2 to 5 were the repeated sequence. In our study, we had 3 outcome measures which we used to infer learning. And learning was, we defined it as a decrease in any of these outcome measures. So the overall tracking error is our primary outcome measure, and its unit of measure is root mean square error. And how we determine that is based on the area, which you see outlined there in yellow. It would be the total area, the difference between what the participant in red has traced versus what the computer in gray has traced. The temporal lag, which is measured in milliseconds, is determined by the distance, as you can see with the black horizontal arrow. Again, the difference between the participant's tracing and the computer's tracing, and that distance is then converted into time. Spatial accuracy is measured in corrected root mean square error. What we mean by that is they take the computer's tracing, and the subject's tracing, and they correlate them so that they overlie, and they correct for that temporal lag that you see. And then they take the area, the difference between what the participant has traced versus what the computer has traced. And Devin will introduce you to our results section.
Thanks, Steph. So in total, we were able to gather 11 complete data sets. Of these 11 data sets, we looked at the averages as well as the standard deviations. We calculated t-test values, and we had effect size values calculated. Our t-test significance level, we took the traditional p-value of 0.05 and divided it by 6, as we did have 6 multiple tests run at the same time, and this corrected for the multiple variations, giving us a p-value of 0.008. So here is an overview of our results. What we did is we averaged the participants' trials and then averaged all the participants together to generate these values. As you can see, we've got the overall tracking error, the spatial accuracy, and the temporal accuracy, and all demonstrate a decrease in the amount of error demonstrated between baseline and retention. I want to pull your attention to the temporal accuracy. With the repeated sequences, which are in red, you can see that there is a larger decrease in the amount of error demonstrated as compared to the random sequences, whereas with the overall tracking error and the spatial accuracy, it seems to be about the same. When we calculated t-test values for these trials, we found that the overall tracking error and the spatial accuracy demonstrated significant differences between the repeated and the retention sequences. However, with the temporal accuracy, we weren't able to demonstrate significance. The problem with t-tests for this study is it doesn't allow us to compare the effect between the random and the repeated sequences. It's basically comparing the apples and the oranges. To do this, we actually needed to calculate an effect size. What the effect size does is it just looks at how effective was that intervention. And in this case, how effective was the learning of a random sequence compared to a repeated sequence. So with the overall tracking error in the first column, you can see that we demonstrate a larger effect size with the repeated as opposed to the random sequences. When you look at the spatial accuracy, you can see that the values are quite close together, whereas the temporal accuracy, there is a much larger difference effect sizes. So here's our values again. An effect size of 0.2 indicates a small effect, 0.5 is a moderate effect, and 0.8 demonstrates a large effect. And as you can see, all of our values show moderate effects. I'd like to pull your attention again down to the temporal values. The repeated temporal effect size of 0.79 does approximate a large effect, and it does show the largest difference from the random temporal, as opposed to when we look at the spatial effects. Those values, again, are quite similar. So a quick summary of these results. This study confirms that sequence-specific implicit motor learning is possible with damage to the MCA, as demonstrated by those effect sizes in the overall tracking error. And our data does suggest that participants show a greater change in the temporal domain as opposed to the spatial domain. So what did this all mean? We know that learning is expected with any novel motor task, and that with task familiarity, we will see an increase in performance and decrease in error. We termed this generalized motor learning. You may know it as practice effect. It's the same concept. With any new task, as you practice it, you'll get better. And this is clearly demonstrated in our data. It doesn't matter if we were looking at the repeated information or the random information, we showed a decrease in error, indicating that there was some generalized motor learning. However, when we get into the data and we look at the difference between the sequence-specific implicit motor learning and the generalized motor learning, we can infer that there is that difference when we compare the effect sizes. So by looking at this effect size, when we compare the repeated to the random, we can see that the repeated sequence showed a larger effect size. Right there. When we break this down a little bit further, the generalized motor learning can be inferred by the random sequence. And when there's quite a large similarity between the values, we can infer that most of that was generalized motor learning. This is beautifully seen in spatial accuracy. There's very little difference between those effect sizes, and that small difference will highlight the implicit motor learning, but the large portion of it is still the generalized motor learning. Over on the temporal accuracy side, we can see that this larger difference does highlight that implicit motor learning that we're looking for, as more effect is due to the implicit motor learning. So, what did we show? In the end, we did show that MCA infarcts show improvement with attentive accuracy, but less improvement was displayed with spatial accuracy. Going back to the cerebellar study that Tessa mentioned in the introduction, they showed the opposite, suggesting that temporal accuracy was impaired, where spatial accuracy did improve. So our study actually does support the fact that implicit learning is diffused through the brain, and that neural networks supplied by the NCA are more involved with spatial accuracy than temporal accuracy. There are a couple of key features that need to be mentioned, though. Daryl don't know if implicit motor learning is a bilateral phenomenon or if it's unilateral, and if knocking out one side of the brain will affect the entire aspect of motor learning, or if we can compensate with the other hemisphere. Also, all of our participants did show strokes, but none of them knocked out the entire NCA, nor did any of them have the same strokes in the same location. So it's hard to say that it's basically hard to make us a hard conclusion about this. Implications for the physiotherapist. Motor learning is capable of no explicit instructions. This is something that we all know and that we should take away from this as well. Here's the question though. If you do have a patient that comes to you with a stroke in the NCA distribution, what would you like to focus on for your rehabilitation? Would you prefer to go after the remediation and try to upregulate that spatial accuracy? Is that where we want to focus our rehab? Or would we rather focus our rehab at the compensation aspect? And would we rather say, we know temporal accuracy can be improved with these people? That's where we want to focus our efforts. At this point, we don't have an answer. So that's where more research is needed. So there were limitations to our study. We did have a limited number of participants at 11. Three participants were unable to complete both the baseline and the retention testing due to their fatigue. So we did average their data and impute the data. As well, one participant was eliminated due to erroneous results, and his data was imputed from an average of all the remaining participants. So in conclusion, individuals with MCA stroke are able to learn new motor sequences implicitly without explicit instruction. Generalized motor learning can be seen in both the spatial and the temporal components. Greater gains are seen in the temporal accuracy as compared to the spatial accuracy with people with MCA strokes. And neural networks supplied by the NCA are involved in spatial accuracy to a greater extent than temporal accuracy. We would like to thank Dr. Laura Boyd and Dr. Janice Ng for their help and their guidance through this study, as well as Elizabeth Dowd, the research coordinator at the Brain Behavior Lab at UBC. This study wouldn't be possible without the Brain Behavior Lab at UBC, and we would like to thank the Department of Physical Therapy at UBC. Here's our references.
Open the floor for questions.
Yeah. At the beginning, in your method, you guys described that you were only taking MCA in parks or functional equivalent. What's a functional equivalent?
That's yours.
All right. We actually have a few extra slides just to kind of help with this one.
Great question.
So here are MRI scans of all of our participants, and you can see the majority of them all have pretty distinctive MCA strokes, except this guy over here, who has a stroke in his pons, actually. So this is him. And what functionally equivalent means is that if you actually saw this person compared to someone with an MCA distribution stroke, they would actually functionally have the same deficits. And the reason for this is because where this person's stroke is it's actually blocking its, all the neural information coming from the structures that are supplied by the middle cerebral artery. And the really cool part about this guy, if you see, I don't actually know if it's a guy, I just refer to him that way. If you see this, that's not another stroke. That's actually atrophy in the middle cerebral artery distribution because the neural information can't get from that structure down because the stroke is actually blocking that information. So at some point in our master's degree, we learned this as diakinesis, diastasis, however I can't remember how to pronounce it. So yeah, that's what we meant. Answer it?
Yeah, Julia.
When you said erroneous results, what did you mean by that?
Basically, that guy had a bad day. He came up on the retention test day and he was not feeling well. He was not, he didn't have a good day. And his data was.
Yeah, so his baseline, over the course of his practice days, he was showing exactly the same sort of picture as everyone else, and then on baseline, he just
On retention testing. It was this very, very strange result. And they have a large pool of subjects. We're only using 11, and they have two other groups. And so just looking at everyone as a picture, it was decided as a group with our supervisor, Dr. Larry Boyd, that it was probably best just to impute that subject.
It was kind of treated like an outlier that you usually see in data, where it's just kind of taken out and then the data's changed.
Just on the title page, I noticed that there was like a citation by your name. Did you guys co-author?
No, that's just linked. That's for the title page of our actual paper. It's just linked to the Department of Physical Therapy and then Brain Behavior Lab.
When you guys use the word impute, what is that process? Like, that's not just throwing it out, that's...
Yeah, basically, because we have four blocks, so if we go back to, I'm going to go way up here. Okay, so because on day one and day seven for the baseline and retention, they did do the four blocks of data, the repeated, the random, and the repeated. These three of the participants for the baseline, one of them was able to complete two of the blocks, and one of them was only able to complete one block. So we actually just averaged those, their data, for the remaining blocks. So that's how the data was imputed for those guys, for both baseline and retention. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, and then the other guy that was just having a bad day, his data was imputed as well.
All we did was we took all the averages from all the participants, and that was his value at the end. So we had 10 values, and then we made the average of those 10 values the 11th value. So it basically didn't change our results at all. We could have thrown them at them.
How would you, it's nice when you have the really controlled environment on the screen and whatnot. Would you expect any difference if there was more motivation in terms of the task? Like if it was something, if it was a $50 bill or a $100 bill that they have to get, do you think that would change the results?
That's a really interesting question, whether the spatial accuracy would reflect the failings of that for them. So that'd be something to take into research and sort of apply it. But I guess you'd have to really individualize that for each participant, and to standardize that would be quite difficult.
It would be tough to do it at that
time. But like 8.9 for practice would probably be interesting to see the results of being just.
So I was looking at actually some of the Boyd research when I was on my last placement, and she had looked at implicit versus explicit motor learning and why, like you guys say, implicit motor learning is useful in stroke. But I was finding it's really difficult to avoid giving explicit information, and actually patients sometimes get really frustrated when you don't tell them things because they think they just can't do stuff. What are your recommendations on how to kind of tailor your practice to based on these results that you guys have to help facilitate people learning conditions?
I guess the best approach, because you do kind of need both, and if your patients are reporting back to you that they are getting frustrated, then it's definitely time to address how they learn. They might be an auditory learner. But I guess setting up situations where you're not giving them really, really cut and dry instructions, where it's more of a general, such as like the walking example, give it a go, we're going to walk down, I'd like you to do this kind of a distance. And then it's just, it's the practice, that the time and practice, the number of repetitions that people in that situation after stroke, they just don't get the repetition that they require to learn new skills. And I believe that's been a point that Dr. Larry Boyd's made several times, that the number of repetitions just aren't there. And so I guess setting up environments where you can up the repetitions, and maybe early on they might get a bit more encouragement and explicit instruction, but do it in such a way that they get to practice with their movements and sort of problem solve for themselves. Kind of along the idea of learning to ride a bike, we basically do just need to try it. There's no description that anyone can give you that would be helpful. Is that?
Yeah, no, that's good. Thank you.
Lindsay? I don't know if you guys looked at this, but do you expect the same kind of results if you were to repeat your retention test after a prolonged period of time?
I mean, studies show that you will see some retention, but it definitely determines how long you wait. Will we see the same results after a year with the same task if there's been no practice? No. But will we see it after a month? Probably. We'd probably see something similar. But it's that time, it's basically the development of the motor skill over time. It's going to happen.
And that kind of ties into the concept of use it or lose it. So this is a task that they won't run into in the course of their daily life. There's no purpose to it for them. But for things like walking or climbing stairs, if it is something that they do have to do daily, that over time they will just continue to improve and they won't taper off.
Part of that also comes to what Stephanie's saying. It's all about the repetitions too, right? They only had a limited number of repetitions in the week, but like if any of you, you know, you thought about when you learned to ride a bike as a kid, if you took 20 years off and didn't ride a bike, you went back to it, you'd remember, and that's probably because you spent hours and hours and hours as a kid knowing, learning how to do it.
Julia?
You mentioned one of your exclusion criteria was an aphasia score.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you use that as an exclusion criteria?
That has to do with the larger study in terms of how they were questioning subject, and just to take that out as a confound so that you're not confusing the fact that there's difficulty with language and comprehension in how they were testing people.
It's also a fairly standard exclusion criteria for stroke subjects because it can be such a confounding variable if you don't have that communication base set up.
What's it actually about? Like, does 13 a bad score?
What is 13?
Oh, I can't remember.
Good question. We should not. So just
yeah, out. We were part of this actual screening process. We came in a little bit later. I've got a question for you guys then. What would you guys go after? Would you go after the remediation? Would you go after the upping up the spatial accuracy? Would you try to train that? Or would you say, screw it, I can't train that. I'm going to go after the temporal accuracy because I know that can get better.
Jess?
I was just going to say, I mean, in real life, it's not like tasks are devoid of one aspect, right? You have temporal and spatial components to any task, but it sounds like, you know, if you're dealing with someone with an MCA stroke, if you wanted to, like, repeated the same task over and over again, it seems like if you just focused on temporal, the spatial would happen as a byproduct. It seems like it doesn't even need a focus based on what you've shown.
All right.
What I found when I was trying to just apply Margoy's implicit versus explicit advice is that it was really hard to do purely with any one person, and that I had several patients who were kind of similar, but they would respond really differently to the same thing. So like you guys found in the lesions being very different between your subjects, I think it's really hard to apply a cookie cutter approach to this. And so I think it's really valuable research, though, to have that in the back of your mind, like this might be an issue, they might have an issue with temporal or spatial, and thinking of the different ways of addressing that, I think, is really valuable because, you know, if you notice that they are having a problem with that feature, then maybe you can do something to help remediate that versus help compensate for it. So I think just it's good to have this kind of research have in the back of your mind there.
And actually, even in terms of analyzing what their problem is, if they keep tripping on the stairs, it might be that it is just that their timing is off and they've got the spatial component. So keeping that in mind, that you need to look at those two pieces because you need both to have a successful skill execution.
I wonder if, like, if you know that the timing's off, if you can say, you know, you need to step earlier than you think you need to, right? So do it. It's going to feel really strange at first, but if you practice this 1,000 times, then maybe that will become the normal.
Mm-hmm.
And also being able to give them the feedback, you know, if they're struggling a lot and they can't understand why they get it, you know, it's really common for people with your type of stroke, you know, you're in the right place, but it's really common for you to have a problem or have a deficit with, you know, getting there at the right time. So you're totally there with the space, but the timing is a little off on that for what we're that might be nice to know.
And Michelle's and Jess and Julia are right. It's the idea of they're really hard to separate. How do you say I'm only going to give explicit instructions or I'm only going to give implicit instructions? Whereas I think the research more shows the amount of explicit instructions, if we're constantly giving feedback, that's where we're going to get the harm. Clearly we have to tell them something to do, and that's a really good point of saying, well, what if you just try stepping earlier? Now practice that 1,000 times, and now we'll go back to after that.
What
is?
Here we go.
I'm just wondering if you notice the difference between people going right brain strokes versus left brain strokes, because like spatial information might be processed more by one side or the other, or if you just have enough subjects to.
It wasn't something we specifically looked at, I think it would definitely be worthwhile looking at. And the other part of that is, like we said earlier in the presentation, is that we aren't sure, like we have some idea of the structures that are involved with implicit learning, but again, we don't know if it's just unilateral or if it's just bilateral. So we don't know, even if it is on the left side, or we know the right side of the spatial is, can the left side take over?
Yeah, that'd be a great place to take the research, though.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I have two. One, Devin, what you said, like just, you know, like maybe just stepping earlier, but with that, what if like kind of with the stepping earlier, the wheels fall off the cart in the whole rest of the gate pattern, then how useful is just that stepping earlier? My thoughts and impression is like it's pretty patient.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And how they're going to respond. Because one person that's stepping earlier can make all the difference in their gate pattern just. Was beautiful. And then another person, it could be like, okay, the exact same temporal problem, but the way that you would treat it would be
completely different.
Has to be completely different.
Yeah.
Can you guys elaborate a little bit on how this actually is tying into the more research? I mean, you talk about more research, but what will that look like, and how does this fit into the greater study in terms of the impact it'll have on the clinical community? Do you guys have any idea?
How does it tie in? Basically, we've looked at the three regions, or so far research has looked at strokes in the basal ganglia, strokes in the cerebellum, and now strokes in the MCA, looking at the separation between the spatial and temporal. If anything, this is generating more questions. It's showing that we really don't know what implicit learning is. We have ideas, we have thoughts, we think it's this, but is it bilateral, is it unilateral? We're not really sure. And because we don't have that knowledge, it just opens up all the different research avenues to go.
Thank you.
Just a question, kind of dovetailing on that one. Do you guys know whether the Brain Behavior Lab has any plans to study young children under the age of 3? Because I saw some preliminary study that said that they haven't developed their implicit motor learning skills yet, and so if they get injured in that time period, they might be impaired for life. So you can't use these implicit strategies. Do you know if they're planning on doing any research on children, or is that not?
I know Lara just did. She just did a study in collaboration with someone in the States, and she presented at Congress if you're there, that was looking at little kids, but it wasn't in this kind of area. I don't think that's her major focus. She tends to generally focus on stroke, so I'm not sure if it's coming out of the UBC lab, but it very well could be coming out somewhere else. But
it also kind of depends which grad students are in,
yeah,
her lab at the time. So if you're interested in that, I can talk to her.
Anyone else?
I was going to ask. All the 11 had the advantage of practice, but how do we know without a control group that the practice had anything to do with the change?
Well, there actually was the two additional groups for the larger study. It was looking at the stimulation with the transcranial magnetic stimulation, which was
our previous study.
And then they had a control group that just had the stimulation with the practice effect. So it's kind of a roundabout way with the stimulation. They were looking to see whether or not the stimulation was actually going to show any increase with the practice effect. So I guess you could kind of extrapolate from that, that if there's no practice, they wouldn't show any gains. But again, that is in conjunction with the TMS. There has been previous research that has shown that without the actual practice of the behavior, you're not going to see the gains.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as the spatial and temporal accuracy, I haven't read anything about that specifically.
Some designs would have, because it wasn't a very long practice period,
right,
would have done one test, waited the appropriate time,
mm-hmm,
and then have done another test, and then have done a sequence with the practice,
mm-hmm,
and that would have helped to kind of rule out any
so
improvement just from mere exposure,
mm-hmm,
you know, which might have been added some rigor.
Yeah.
What about in your inclusion-exclusion criteria? Vision is really important. And what provision was made either from involvement from the stroke or from previous? You're dealing probably with elderly people. I forget what your average age or range was.
Our range was 53 to 78.
Mm-hmm. And you get cataracts and you get...
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I can't remember any specific
criteria specifically related to vision.
That address that.
And then the other question was, I mean, it was just a one-liner, in your exclusion criteria, but I think it was a very important one, and that is that they had to have the requisite ability and functional capacity in that arm. How is that defined?
We looked at the Pugelmeier. We said you needed to have at least a 20 on the Pugelmeier.
At least a 20.
But the 20 on the Pugelmeier could involve a different aspect where they weren't able to complete the task. So it was effectively a clinical decision. If they met the exclusion and the inclusion criteria to be involved in the study, but it was clear they simply just couldn't function.
Or if they were the task.
Yeah.
Too fatigued.
Yeah.
Which happened in a couple of our subjects as well. And it would be something from our supervisor that was.
And my last question regarding the experimental paradigm. Now, these individuals were flat on their back, and there are not too many things I understand that one does flat on their back. But think about the functional extrapolation of that? And because you do, you know, where you are in space is very much governed by where you are in relation to gravity.
Unfortunately, our protocol is limited by the MRI for the larger study. Subjects for their baseline and retention would actually be in the MRI with the apparatus, and they'd be looking at a screen through a mirror system in the MRI. So to standardize everything, because they have to be supine for the MRI, we did supine for the experimental task. And because we're just using a control group, that's what we have to work with. But
I think we have to be a bit careful. It's a bit of a leap to go from this very structured, rigid, flat on your back paradigm to, you know, functional tasks and ADL and walking, you know, I think that's quite a difference. Any remaining questions?
I have a quick question with regards to your exclusion criteria. I noticed that you exclusively use people with ischemic stroke. Is there a reason why you ruled out the hemorrhagic stroke people if they do present the same functional deficits, since one of your inclusion criteria was people with ischemic stroke in the MCA or functional equivalent?
That's a good question. Again, these inclusion-exclusion criteria were set before we joined the project. And I would just hazard a guess as to just for standardization among subjects. And
so you are
looking at more of an older population when it is an ischemic stroke versus hemorrhagic, and more deficit.